HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Upside-Down World, Meetings with the Dutch Masters, by Benjamin Moser, read by Paul Bamer. Introduction. The Way It Had to Be. When I was 25, I moved to the Netherlands. The reason was a love affair. The place, I thought, was a detail. My interest in its culture was modest. My concerns were personal. Starting life with my Dutch partner. Starting life as a writer. These beginnings were so delicate, so fraught, that I hardly had time to think about anything else. But as I started exploring this new country and tried to find a path as a writer, I stumbled upon a whole galaxy of artists who had seemed to be asking the same questions that I was. Why do we make art? And why do we need it? Who and what is an artist? What does it mean to have talent? And how can one develop whatever one has been given? Can an artist be a follower, or must he be original? What is the artist's duty to others, to society, to self? What is beauty, and how does it relate to taste? How can art help us see ourselves, and how can it help us see others? In a world without religion, can art provide a substitute for God? How, in a word, are we supposed to live? And must we go all the way to the end? None of these questions had answers, or at least none that were satisfactory, and that was how I sensed that I had found a great subject. I didn't know that it would end up consuming me for 20 years, the time it has taken me to write this book. But I did not begin with these questions, or with the intention of writing a book. I began with the same excitement that I felt when, as a child, I stood in front of the skeleton of a dinosaur, or when I first saw the Rosetta Stone, that thrill of finding oneself in a room packed with old and mysterious things. The room, or rooms, was the Dutch museums. One unfolded into the next, gallery after gallery, wing upon wing. My discovery of these rooms was one of the revelations of my life. It had a strange effect on me. I discovered that I could walk through these rooms the way I might walk through a cathedral or a forest, and that I would emerge from them the way I emerged from a good night's sleep or a long jog, calmer, happier, more focused. And I felt that there was something here I needed to know. I didn't know what. I did know that there are places you visit and are happy to have seen, but never need to see again. I did know that there are people you enjoy meeting, enjoy spending an evening with, and whom, with no hard feelings, you never need to see again. And I knew that there are places and people that get under your skin. You want to know everything about them. They make you fall in love. That is how I felt about Dutch art. At first I felt the pleasure, the beauty of this art. I felt its effect on me. It calmed me. It excited me. Somehow it calmed and excited me. Simultaneously. But I didn't know anything about what I was seeing. I started jotting down notes, trying to keep track of it all. You know you are in the presence of a great subject when it raises more questions than answers, and when you realize that the subject gets bigger the more you learn about it, that the more you learn, the more ignorant you start to feel. At first, I was embarrassed by my ignorance. I considered myself a reasonably well-educated person. but I had no idea what I was seeing. I had a quick suburban acquaintance with Rembrandt and Vermeer, and might not have gone much further if they had been the only great artists that Holland produced. But the astonishing thing about Dutch art was just how much of it there was. Every time I walked into a museum, I was sure to discover some spectacular something by some unknown someone. I wanted to know more. I started reading. I visited as many exhibitions as I could. Slowly, I got to know these artists, and as I did, something happened. The process reminded me of the Scooby-Doo cartoons I had watched as a child. In a haunted house beehived with secret passageways, the culprit had cut out the eyes of old portraits. As the group wandered down the spooky hallways, the eyes in the pictures started to move. I read more. I saw more, and as I did, the old pictures started to come alive. I was eager to share the pleasure I had in this learning. I liked nothing more than taking a visitor around a Dutch museum, though I worried that I could come across with the zeal of a convert. I was a foreigner, after all, and part of my enthusiasm for Dutch art was the desire, sometimes touching, sometimes embarrassing, of a person trying to find his footing in a new country. That is how this book began. The country became more familiar. The years passed. All that reading, all that exhibition going, and then the beginnings of this book made me a more knowledgeable guide. I was not, in fact, especially knowledgeable, not at first, and not in the technical sense. I was helped to appear so by the general ignorance of the subject, even among the Dutch. Over time, I did grow less ignorant about the facts, which were available to anyone who bothered to look them up. More eyes started to move, and as they did, I discovered that my ignorance was of another nature. I thought I was learning, and then writing, about the history of art. I didn't know until I was deep into writing this book what I was actually doing, which was recording an education that went far beyond the pictures on the walls, recording my responses to people who had been asking the same kinds of questions that I was asking. Their answers were inconclusive and contradictory and often terrifying. But I didn't need their answers. I needed their questions. I needed to see how they had asked them, since they were the questions I had to formulate before I could offer any answers of my own. For 20 years, half of my life so far, I felt that these artists were guiding me, carrying me through their world. But though their country grew more familiar, it was never my country, and I remained a foreigner, one who had traded the world from which I came for an uncertain life in a new land. It was a baffling experience. Becoming a foreigner could sometimes feel like experiencing dementia. You are you, same name, address, date of birth, but your past is wiped away. You don't know what anyone is talking about or who anyone is, and you start to wonder who you are yourself. I walked down the brick streets like the legal alien that I was, and often thought of a metaphor dear to old painters. A little globe, wrong side up, alludes to an expression still used in Dutch, de omgekeerde wereld. Or, de wereld op zijn kop, the upside-down world, or the world stood on its head. This is what you say when something unexpected happens when the normal order of things is reversed. When a queen holds the door open for a commoner, or when it's warm and sunny in the middle of December. The theme recurs at Carnival. It was popular among the comic painters and the painters of daily life. It is also a concise symbol for what happens when you become a foreigner. You stand on some other portion of the globe. What was up is suddenly down. If it is a great enrichment to be able to see the world from a different standpoint, it is also a great risk. It takes a while to learn that the questions are more important than the answers. At first, you don't know where to look. You don't know where you are or what you're looking at. You don't even know where to start. Part 1. Where to start. Shortly after I got to the Netherlands, I bought a book, or rather a series of books, by the American historian John Lothrop Motley. It was a 19th century edition, printed on thick rag paper that was still bright and unspotted after 150 years. But these books were not collectibles. They were ratty when I bought them, and falling apart by the time I reached the end. I was surprised, in fact, that I reached the end. But the books were so momentous, so resonant, so full of incident and color, that I read them with as much pleasure as I have read anything in my life. Born in 1814, a Bostonian of a generation that produced so many fascinating eccentrics, Motley, among whose interesting attainments was having been Otto von Bismarck's college roommate, published 3 volumes of The Rise of the Dutch Republic, followed by the 4 volumes of The History of the United Netherlands, before and during the Civil War. They told the story of the Dutch Revolt, which began in 1566 as a local rebellion, really no more than a riot, in terms designed to appeal to Americans. He called William of Orange, who reluctantly led the revolt, the Washington of the 16th century. He described the story of Dutch independence as a portion of the records of the Anglo-Saxon race, essentially the same, whether in Friesland, England, or Massachusetts. The maintenance of the right by the little provinces of Holland and Zeeland in the 16th, by Holland and England united in the 17th, and by the United States of America in the 18th centuries, forms but a single chapter in the great volume of human fate, for the so-called revolutions of Holland, England, and America are all links of one chain. Motley emphasized Dutch characteristics that Americans saw as their own. The Dutch wanted to be independent politically, to practice their own religion, to shake off tyrannical kings. They were a nation of traders and shopkeepers who rose to unprecedented power, and through their revolt they had stubbornly refused to be enslaved. No American reading this amid their own civil war would have failed to note the resonance. The books and the heroic story they told were popular for decades. The story was couched in a style as majestic as 19th-century writing can be, and that style, the prose equivalent of the grand operas that were its contemporaries, propelled me through volume after thrilling volume. And they had another use. They gave me a place to start getting to know the history of the country where I had ended up. In the 15th century, the Netherlands, what we now know as the Netherlands, alongside Belgium, Luxembourg, and chunks of Germany and France, were attached by a series of inheritance to the Habsburg rulers of Spain. It was an immensely unwieldy construction, and it was not yet cemented when, in 1517, Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door of Wittenberg Church. Protestantism spread. In the Netherlands, for two generations, an edgy peace alternated with heightened enforcement of Spanish authority, which implied the suppression of religious dissent. This suppression was sharpened with the arrival of Philip II on the Spanish throne. In Motley's telling, Philip was a dumb and genocidal psychotic, and he cracked down on the Netherlanders. Among other things, this was self-defeating, since these provinces, which had long enjoyed a great deal of local autonomy, were far richer than threadbare Spain. Their response to the repression was ferocious and resulted in a war that began in 1568 and concluded only with the Peace of Westphalia, signed 80 years later in 1648. By the end of the 80 Years' War, the Dutch Republic, a small country of hardly more than 1 million inhabitants, was one of the leading powers in the world. Militarily, for a time, the Dutch were invincible. Economically, they were rich, the inventors of the multinational corporation and the stock exchange. Scientifically, inside drops of rainwater and sperm, deep into the night sky, and far into the unvisited regions of the world, they made one startling discovery after the next. They founded colonies from Brazil to South America and from Java to Manhattan. Their radical philosophers made tyrants tremble, and the books that they printed in dozens of languages were read across the world. Their religious tolerance attracted large communities of dissenters. Their women were freer than any other in Europe. Their artists created a breathtaking collection of masterpieces. The more I read Motley, the more invigorating, the more exhilarating I found the Golden Age. I wanted to know more. But if all those achievements in all those fields gave me a sense of excitement about the place I had ended up, they were daunting, too. There was so much that it was hard to know where to begin. My natural tendency was to start with their art, and within that art, among their thousands of accomplished artists, I knew that there could only be one place to begin. And so, I began with the greatest artist of the Golden Age, and followed his genealogy, as through the generations of a royal house, down to his greatest successor. 1. Rembrandt, the Shadow Master.
On July 15, 1945, Rembrandt's 339th birthday, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam reopened with the most emotionally charged exhibition in its history.
Called Reunion of the Masters, the show gathered 175 paintings that had spent the 5 years of the occupation hidden in bunkers. During those 5 years, private collections were looted, and museums were emptied of their greatest works. For all the average person knew, these treasures, like so many others, had been stolen or destroyed in the Nazi terror. Now they were making a triumphant return to the center of Amsterdam. From The Hague came Fabricius's goldfinch, Potter's bull, Vermeer's pearl earring. From Haarlem came the great Hals Group portraits, which were displayed alongside the Rijksmuseum's own collection, including, of course, the nation's famous Rembrandts. In 1939, with war looming, the huge Night Watch, 11 by 14 feet, had been taken to a vault made of reinforced concrete in a castle in North Holland. The location proved too dangerous. In 1940, when the Germans invaded, It was hastily removed to a bunker in Kostrikum, closer to Amsterdam. The painting was covered with a canvas borrowed from a local farmer. The journey of 50 kilometers took 12 hours. At one point, when an enemy plane appeared overhead, its escorts took refuge in neighboring fields, leaving the masterpiece alone and unguarded in the middle of the road. When it finally reached its destination, its caretakers discovered that it was too large for the entrance and it had to be rolled up. Finally, in 1942, it was taken to a special storage site near Maastricht, where it was kept in a limestone quarry 33 meters underground. The director of the Frans Hals Museum, Henk Bart, recalled the scene. Through the slow progress of the silent bearers, the remarkable spectacle under its ghostly lighting recalled a princely funeral. Now it was back. 165,000 people eventually visited the show. In a country that still lacked basic provisions, many of these visitors came on an empty stomach. All understood its promise. The past glory would bring future resurrection. A people that can display such a parade of greatness shall reclaim its special place, a journalist wrote. At the opening, a minister declared that the Canadians who liberated Holland have also liberated Rembrandt and Frans Hals. More than Hals, Rembrandt needed that liberation. He needed it more, in fact, than any other Dutch artist. Hitler had declared him a true Aryan and German, and under the Quisling regime he had become the focus of a bizarre cult, his birthday even replacing the exiled Queen Wilhelmina's as the national holiday. Now this unwitting German hero would become, once again, the symbol of the dignity of a free people. Light had chased out the darkness. It was precisely the kind of cosmic struggle that Rembrandt had illustrated in his works, though that struggle rarely had such a clean outcome. History was recapitulating the trajectory of Rembrandt's own evolution. If Vermeer was a painter of light, Rembrandt was a painter of dark commingled with light, and in his work the question of evil recurs more than in any other Dutch artist's, so insistently that looking at his pictures is sometimes unbearable. There are more scenes of murder, cruelty, torture, rape, betrayal, malediction, and death in Rembrandt than in any other Dutch painter's work by far. Vermeer painted no such scenes. Neither did Hals. Neither did any of the blither spirits, Hendrik Averkamp, or Pieter de Hooch, or Jan Steen. At the very most, the landscapists and the still-life painters will allude with some graceful symbol to mortality, to the passing of time. Most Dutch paintings were made for the wealthy middle classes and show things those people liked to see.
Who among them would have wanted a picture like The Blinding of Samson, in which a silver dagger is plunged into the hero's eye?
The painting is so gigantic, 2 by 3 meters, that it's hard to look away from it. It is just as hard to look at it. Even Delilah can hardly contemplate her victim without a shiver. Rembrandt was so prolific that even the most ambitious museum survey will never capture more than a slice of his work. Books aren't much use either. The images end up crammed onto the page, and that monumental quality of Rembrandt's paintings, their patina, their glow, the sense that they give of something physical, like an extraordinary geological phenomenon, goes missing too, flattened onto smooth paper. The etchings and drawings, originally made on paper, fare better in reproduction. but there are hundreds of them, and even the most avid eye can absorb only so much. To try to see more than a few at a time is to get a reminder that, as with Dante and Shakespeare and Bach, you cannot rush an acquaintance with Rembrandt. His work took a long time to make, after all, nearly half a century between his earliest productions and the works he made in the days before his death at 63. Add, to the quantity of works and media, the quantity of genres.
In England, writers were comedians or tragedians or poets, but only Shakespeare was the greatest in every field.
In Holland, Rembrandt, who was 9 when Shakespeare died, worked in nearly every specialty known to Dutch art, each of which absorbed the energies, the entire lives, of his most talented contemporaries. And then there is the profusion of his styles. These make it even harder to form a coherent image of Rembrandt. Many Rembrandts do not look anything like the popular idea of a Rembrandt. His early works look so different from his later work that the early works were not even recognized as such until deep into the 19th century. Over the years, all sorts of ghastly paintings have been attached to his name, including some that he actually painted. There are still occasional rediscoveries today, though these are nearly always of lesser works that seldom add more than a footnote to the image that has emerged from 200 years of dogged scholarship. The lacunae of that scholarship only seem to yawn in comparison to a demand for completeness. We now know as much about Rembrandt as we know about almost any figure, artistic or otherwise, of his century. We have a large group of works. We know what they show. We know when they were painted, and often, why and for whom. We can see that some themes interested the master only for a short period. We can see that others were there from the beginning and stayed with him until the end. Some come back in every medium, in every style, at every point in his career, and one such recurring theme is violence, evil, darkness. The spectacle of cruelty is there in his earliest signed painting, The Stoning of St. Stephen. He painted it in 1625 when he was 19. It shows a crowd surrounding the first Christian martyr, stones held high, ready to smash him to pieces. Unlike the Samson, it is not hard to look at. It is too much of an apprentice piece to feel real, but though he is not visibly joining in, it is a bit disturbing to find a chubby teenage Rembrandt among the crowd. A few years later, the novice has matured into a master. Rembrandt was 26 when he painted The Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Nicolas Tulp. This is a portrait of 8 men around the corpse of Aris Kint, who had been convicted for armed robbery and executed earlier that morning. The men are wearing neat clothing, and their expressions range from technical curiosity to a keen realization, or do we just imagine it, that they themselves will soon be just as dead as Aris Kint. Despite the decorous scientific proceedings and the sober expressions on the doctor's faces, the smell of rot tickles your nostrils. You could derive a positive message from this painting. You were, in fact, intended to by those who commissioned it, if not necessarily by the artist. The doctor is instructing the public with lessons that demonstrate the Dutch commitment to progressive education, lessons that were commemorated with such paintings because the medical societies were prestigious and famed. Rembrandt was one of many artists invited to paint them. When, 24 years later, he returned to the theme, he showed Dr. Jan Dehmann dissecting Johann Fontaine, who broke into a draper.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?